It's the Debating God edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, it's back to basics without how to debate charismatic Christian apologists. Let's begin episode 241.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. It's me, Don, your political scientist and skeptical philosopher. I was listening to a podcast, Reasonable Doubts. The episode was a virtual debate about the rational belief in God. Virtual as in one side recorded an opening statement, emailed it to a moderator, who in turn sent it to the other side. Upon receiving a rebuttal, forward it, etc., etc., you kind of get the picture. I mentioned the format because unlike other debates where you have the, oh, I wish I'd said that moment, well, from what I understand, these guys had over a week to form their responses, so you would have thought they would have done it well. There has been much discussion in the skeptic community as to whether we should participate in debates on issues of pure bunk with charismatic opponents. The fear is that at best, debating implies at least possible validity for their side, and at worst, we could look the fool and appear to lose the debate in the eyes of the audience. It's that fear of apparent loss that scares us the most. We're sure of the science and the logic, but the debates are not about logic, but rhetoric. You can win the minds, but lose the hearts of the audience. We tend to lose the hearts a fair bit, at least in public debates. And that is always what takes precedent. So this is not intended so much as an argument against the proofs of God, although that will be covered, but explaining how they are used, what version of God is being discussed, where should we counter, and what is the target of our counter-argument. I also hope to cover ways one can be sidetracked by apologists and ways to overcome that. It's important to remember outright that in a debate, especially an open public debate, it is not the person who is right that wins, but which performance wows the audience. It is equally important to remember that you are not going to convince your opponents they're wrong. If you ask them at the start, is there any amount of proof that would make you change your mind? If honest, most will say no. They believe in spite of the evidence. That's their faith. Of course, to be fair, there is no theistic argument or evidence that would make me believe in at least the traditional version of God. Some have said, well, if tomorrow the stars aligned and spelled out, "Hello, Dawn, it's God. Is this good enough?" I would have to say no. It's possible powerful aliens are moving the stars around, or that it's a freakish coincidence, or more likely I'm experiencing a hallucination. And that would explain why any number of other people may be saying they're sharing the experience. Because, I mean, if I could imagine a stellar spectacle, then I could equally imagine other people supporting it. In fact, it's even more likely that it might be some form of mass hallucination than it ever possibly could be God. All those things are infinitely more plausible than a supernatural deity. So the target is the audience. You are providing an alternative answer to those that were given by the theist, those who are not all in on God, like your opponent is. That is also why it's important to ensure you do not take things personally. Don't get mad or frustrated if your opponent seems to be deliberately obtuse. They are being deliberately obtuse. It's part of how they win, making you look arrogant, judgmental, and opinionated. So where do you start? Well, most atheists, or at least most skeptics, will start logically, at least from our perspective, by stating the question and defining the terms. The theist mind, it doesn't work that way. The question is irrelevant. Their terms are God is everything, whatever version that supports their current point. Again, they understand the objective, not a sound argument, but winning rhetoric. Many atheist debaters find themselves arguing the wrong question. They provide a great argument about a loving God. Many atheist debaters will find themselves arguing the wrong question. They'll provide a great argument about why an all-loving God is not possible, only to find the response, "That doesn't matter. It was God that made everything. Who are we to say whether he loves us or not?" The playbook here is to be comfortable with a shifting target. Terms will be flexible. Just make sure you have enough rhetorical arrows to shoot down the various wild geese they hope you'll be chasing. That said, it's important that you don't create a bad question. The disastrous debate I mentioned earlier had as its point, can a rational person believe in God? It didn't start out that way. The original question is it rational to believe in God? The atheist dutifully explained belief in God was irrational. The theist sidestepped this question and argued, what is rational belief? That rational people believe rationally in things that later turned out to be false. This pivot not only threw off the atheist debater, but gave rhetorical advantage to the theist. He then avoided the one day may be proven wrong by doubling down on the irrational beliefs themselves that they can be real because rational people believe in irrational things all the time. Love is irrational. My fear of heights is irrational. That doesn't make me irrational, nor does it make my fears any less real. It therefore follows that even if you could prove belief in God is irrational, God still exists like love exists. And the theist for the win. Okay, so let's start with the whole argument. Let's check out some of the basic arguments for the existence of God. First, we'll do the ologicals, the cosmological, ontological, and teleological argument. The cosmological argument is the argument that all things must have a beginning, a thing from which it arose, also called the prime mover argument. I'm going to use the Dr. William Lang Krang, infamous among the atheist community, version of these arguments where possible, because it is the best face, I think, of the opposition. He understands it's not a quest for knowledge we're after, but a quest for hearts. He also understands we skeptics are slaves to logic, so he will frame his responses in the right language of skepticism, but then abuse reason to promote his views. Take note, most of his arguments are given in formal deductive logical format. Those not blessed with a degree in philosophy accept the forms of the arguments are sound. That's geek speak for saying good and proper, but does not necessarily mean that they are true. So here is Craig's explanation of the cosmological or prime mover argument.
The cosmological argument. It goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore, the universe has a cause. Is the first premise true? Let's consider. Believing that something can pop into existence without a cause is more of a stretch than believing in magic. At least with magic, you've got a hat and a magician. And if something can come into being from nothing, then why don't we see this happening all the time? No, everyday experience and scientific evidence confirm our first premise. If something begins to exist, it must have a cause. But what about our second premise? Did the universe begin? Or has it always existed? First, let's consider the second law of thermodynamics. It tells us the universe is slowly running out of usable energy. And that's the point. If the universe had been here forever, it would have run out of usable energy by now. The second law points us to a universe that has a definite beginning. More recently, three leading cosmologists, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin, prove that any universe which has on average been expanding throughout its history cannot be eternal in the past, but must have an absolute beginning. It's quite plausible then that both premises of the argument are true. This means that the conclusion is also true. The universe has a cause. And since the universe can't cause itself, its cause must be beyond the space-time universe. It must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, uncaused, and unimaginably powerful. Much like God.
Note, as a logical argument, the form is sound. That is, if, big if here, if the premises are true, the conclusion must be true. So are the premises necessarily true? Let's break that down. Does everything have a beginning? Are there timeless, eternal things? He states that from our experience in science, yes, he's using our own prime weapon against us, that everything has a cause, a source that brought it into being. Well, first, science may say that it believes there was a beginning to the universe, but not necessarily a beginning in the way that he means it. Secondly, science, the quantum mechanic parts, has as a provable fundamental fact that actually things do appear and disappear spontaneously. i.e. something out of nothing. This is hard for us to show in a debate because quantum fluctuations and virtual particles are hard to explain and counterintuitive. Most of quantum mechanics is counterintuitive. The best step here is to kind of sidestep explaining quantum mechanics. As magical, to use Ken's terms, as it may appear, it is what makes computers on your desktop work. It makes medical scanners work. Even your USB memory stick works by this magic, or shall we call it quantum mechanics. So the other premise is that all things that begin have a cause. If the universe started at the Big Bang, what caused the Big Bang? We could say that there is an infinite cycle of births and death, a self-perpetuating universe. A Big Bang, a Big Crunch leads to a new Big Bang. However, the current view of science, thanks to dark energy, is that the universe will end in what they call a cold death. That is, a universe that will expand until such a point that energy is so diffuse that everything will be near absolute zero. But that assumes two important things. A, this is not a one-time thing. Our sun will eventually die, full stop. That doesn't mean that we need to add a sun god to explain why there is no renewed sun. It just ends. A universe accidentally created by a quantum fluctuation is not as dramatic as parting the Red Sea, but it is much more plausible. Also, he mentioned that many scientists point to a finite universe, or even multi-universe, but only if we assume that the average universe is expanding. We can't know that. It's possible that if our universe fails to collapse on its own, a neighboring universe may have extra energy to sort of help ours collapse at some future point. So the two premises are not necessarily true. The conclusion is where he pulls the big bait and switch. Even if we accept his argument as presented, he then asserts from out of nowhere, and this is not from his argument, but can be very persuasive to an audience light in their logic or science, he asserts that the universe must have come from a, quote, spaceless, timeless, immaterial, uncaused, and powerful source. First off, one must point out, anything that does not exist in space and time and is immaterial is by definition non-existent. So that's actually a proof against God. But uncaused, why? Could there not be a cause for the cause for the universe? If God is uncaused, then a non-deistic cause may also be uncaused. And we have no idea how much power is needed to create a universe. That leads to the ultimate answer and problem. It's what we philosophical people call an epistemic barrier. We don't know. But that's not the same as saying as we don't not know. Confused? Well, at the moment of the Big Bang, any evidence that was prior to that event was destroyed. Think about if I wrote something on a nuclear bomb that blew up. Once the bomb goes off, there is no way that we know of yet, and that's an important yet, no way to know what was written on the bomb. It does not mean that there was not writing, but evidence for it is beyond our current understanding. But because we don't know what it was, does not show that we don't know what it was not. I can state with a large degree of certainty, it was not written on with nuclear acid, as that would have dissolved the bomb before it could have detonated. I could argue that it was written with unobtainium, but as that does not actually exist, I now have two hurdles. First, that unobtainium actually exists, and then that it was used to write on the bomb. So it is valid to claim that we are unsure of what happened before the Big Bang, but that does not mean it must be God. In fact, it's an important point to make to the audience, to make them understand, that the skeptic need only account for some natural precursor to the universe. The theist has two hurdles to cross, a precursor, and that precursor was God. We already know the universe exists. We already know that there are laws of nature. The theist has yet to prove God. And be careful about pulling the circular logic card. God created the universe exists, therefore God exists, is logically unsound, but to regular people, it makes a kind of sense. So the best you can hope for with this argument is accept that history has shown, unlike religion, that what was unknowable in the past, as with the advancements in science and not in theology, has become known. One time, we didn't know how people were made, but now we knew and we understand genetics. And so we may not know now what happened before the beginning of the universe. But it's important to point out to the audience that the theist really hasn't answered that question either. Now, do not get sidetracked. This is not the God of love. It is not the brilliant God of design. The only importance of this god is that he was before and outside of existence. Don't laugh. Atheists would agree that God is outside of existence, but we think that means does not exist. Theist thinks, woo, beyond the stars or something. Okay, the next argument we're going to tackle is the ontological argument. The classic argument goes that God is the most perfect being possible. An existent being is more perfect than a non-existent being, therefore God must exist. You can alter the wording a bit, but this has been debunked centuries ago. Think sort of the perfect unicorn. And who says existence is better than not? There is a new version of the argument that states that if, well, let's go back to Craig.
The possibility of God's existence. Now, I've rarely shared this argument in a public lecture before, not because I think it's unsound, but because it's so abstract. Now, in order to understand this argument, you first need to understand what philosophers mean by possible worlds. A possible world is just a way the world might have been. It's just a world description. The actual world is the description that is true. Other possible worlds are descriptions that might have been true, but are not in fact true. To say that something exists in some possible world is to say that there is some description of reality which includes that entity. To say that something exists in every possible world is to say that no matter which description is true, the entity will be included in that description. Consider the ontological argument. God is by definition the greatest being conceivable, maximally great being. So, what would such a being be like? Well, he would be all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, and he would exist in every logically possible world. Now, we can summarize this argument as follows. Number one, it's possible that a maximally great being, aka God, exists. Two, if it's possible that a maximally great being exists, then a maximally great being exists in some possible world. Three, if a maximally great being exists in some possible world, then it exists in every possible world. Four, if a maximally great being exists in every possible world, then it exists in the actual world. Five, therefore, a maximally great being exists in the actual world. Six, therefore, a maximally great being exists. Seven, therefore, God exists.
It's interesting to note that Craig says he doesn't like to pull out this argument because it's technical and unintuitive. And here again, we see he understands it's not information he is peddling, but theater, that he knows rhetoric trumps information. First, to recap, he brings up the many worlds idea, or multiple universe, as we hear it in the popular press. He says it's possible for a maximal entity, i.e. God, to exist. That is, there's no logical contradictions to the concept of God. Now, as for whether the definition of God is contradictory, well, it will depend on your definition. Craig points out that steps 2 through 7, i.e. if we accept the first premise, the rest are non-controversial in philosophical community. Strictly speaking, the idea that a possible entity must exist in at least one possible universe implies that there are an infinite number of universes. But the word infinite, in our context, is simply a number beyond our comprehension. There is literally, and I mean literally in its original literal definition, there is no way for us to know if our idea of infinite equates to a multiverse that actually has every possible combination of elements to, quote, create a god. There is also another contradiction with the first argument, where it is stated that God exists outside of the universe. That's how he created the universe to begin with. So in this argument, the theists acknowledge that for God to exist, he must exist in the universe. Remember I said the target will be moving. The first argument had to place God outside the universe so as to be the creator. Now they need him inside to prove his existence. Remember we pointed out that the end of the cosmological argument, the theist needs to prove God's existence as opposed to some other prime cause. This contradiction should be pointed out to the audience, that the theist definition is inconsistent. You might quip, but with caution, that this may not be a problem for Dan Brown, because he knows his characters are fiction, so consistency need not be applied. Another contradiction emanating from the premise one, God is the greatest being possible. Well, there is the problem of evil and many other arguments that question this premise. But let's remember, we're talking about a debate and not about the best answer or the truth. This argument is intended not to persuade the audience, but to reinforce their belief that God is perfect. Believers don't care about possible worlds, except that their universe was the chosen one. They don't care if a perfect God also proves there must also be perfect unicorns or perfect pizzas. You cannot win the argument that God is both loving and permits evil unless some horrific life event happens to that believer. They will explain away as God knows more than me. The best you can do here is to point out the contradiction. The logic is not as solid as portrayed, and then move along. When we come back, we'll discuss the arguments from design.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back. We've discussed the cosmological and ontological arguments for the proofs of God. Then there's the teleological argument, or argument by fine-tuning or intelligent design, also known as the anthropomorphic argument. This argument holds that, well, let's go back to Craig, but I should note that I did some editing for brevity and clarity. I should also point out on a humorous note that this lecture or debate, I say debate because this was a fictional debate between Craig and Richard Dawkins, where Craig is arguing with an empty chair. Yes, as in Clint Eastwood at the Republican convention crazy. And for the record, Craig was imitating Clint Eastwood and not the other way around. So here's the teleological explanation explained.
Here's a simple formulation of the teleological argument based on the fine-tuning of the universe. Premise one, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Two, it is not due to physical necessity or chance. Three, therefore, it is due to design. Now, with respect to premise one, perhaps I'd better explain to our audience what is meant by fine-tuning. This expression does not mean designed. Otherwise, the argument would be obviously circular, claiming that the best explanation of design is design. Rather, during the last 50 years or so, scientists had discovered that the existence of intelligent, interactive life anywhere in the cosmos depends upon a delicate and complex balance of initial conditions simply given in the Big Bang itself. If nature's fundamental constants and quantities were to be altered by less than a hair's breadth, this life-permitting balance would be destroyed, and no living, interactive organisms of any kind could exist anywhere in the cosmos. Now, premise one simply lists the three possibilities for explaining the presence of this amazing fine-tuning. And the question then is, which is the best explanation? Well, premise two addresses that question. The first alternative, physical necessity, is extraordinarily implausible because the values of the constants and quantities are independent of the laws of nature. The laws of nature are consistent with a wide range of values for these constants and quantities. So, what about the second alternative, that the fine-tuning of the universe is due to chance? Well, it seems to me that the problem with this alternative is that the odds against the universe's being life-permitting are so incomprehensibly great that they cannot be reasonably faced. Who designed the designer? In order to recognize an explanation as the best, you don't need to have an explanation of the explanation. This is an elementary point in the philosophy of science. If astronauts were to discover a pile of machinery on the backside of the moon, they would be justified in inferring that this was the product of intelligent agents, even if they had no idea whatsoever who these agents were or how they got there. In order to recognize an explanation as the best, you don't need to have an explanation of the explanation. So, to sum up, of the three alternatives before us, physical necessity, chance, or design, the most plausible explanation of the cosmic fine-tuning is design.
Note he says, which is the best explanation? He does not mean the plausible or most likely, but the one we most want or think might be true. The crux of this argument is that the universe, one that allows our existence, must arise out of one of three reasons. First one, chance. Here we find that the theist debater is being self-contradictory. In the ontological argument, they depend on the premise that there is an infinite number of universes. Ergo, in at least one possible universe, God exists. If there was only one, then there is no necessity for God's existence. Here, however, they say there is only one universe. Why? Because if you had an infinite number of universes, then at least one world would be ours. No God required. Being intellectually nimble, emphasize the shifting points, that the ontological argument negates the cosmological argument. Now the teleological one negates the ontological argument. You may take another quick point by thanking the theist for providing another argument that disproves his previous argument. The second option, the crux of that argument rests on the idea of physical necessity. This is not logical necessity, where necessity is true by definition. This just means that the laws slash constants of the universe came out because of some overarching law. So when we add CO2 to water and we get fizzy drink, it did not become carbonated because of chance, but because of the laws of physics and chemistry necessitated that reaction. The theist is saying that there is no law of cosmic constants that makes the universe just the perfect universe it is. This is what we call in the philobiz an epistemic question, or a question of knowledge. It is true, from what we currently understand about cosmology, the constants of the universe, the speed of light, the force of gravity, the value of electron, etc., these are independent and sort of random, for lack of a better word. But history has shown that as time flows and science progresses, we have a greater understanding of the world, that we discover connections between things that seemed unconnected. 100 years ago, we had no idea how genes were responsible for how our bodies developed. Back then, it was a miracle if a child was born tall, or damnation if they suffered from something like Down syndrome or something. Now, we know these are not random events, but predictable outcomes of genetic conditions. It is possible, one might be optimistic to say probable, that we will discover that the fundamental constants of the universe are not random, but predicted by some underlying symmetry that we are as yet unable to understand. Of course, the theist is going to come back and say, oh yes, but God designed said symmetry. You can never win with them. The point to make here is that not knowing X is not the same as knowing Y. You don't know why our clocks have 60 minutes, but that's not the same as saying the clocks must have been made by aliens with 60 fingers. Now let me tell you about the watchmaker argument. If you found a watch on a beach, you would not think it came into being naturally, but it must have had a maker, the watchmaker. However, the theist argues that the watchmaker himself could not have come about naturally. He must have had a maker, a god. You might retort, if I came across a deity in the multiverse that was so perfectly constructed as God, well, it could not have arisen out of random chance. As the clock must have had a clockmaker, God must have had a godmaker. God needs a maker, and the godmaker also needs a godmaker maker. And etc. You keep going on reductum ad absurdum. Sorry, but how many times do you get to use your Latin? It means reduce the argument to absurdity. Because you would need turtles all the way down. Okay, sorry again. Discworld inside joke. The funniest, for those insiders, is when Craig says in response to a hypothetical, well, it actually comes from Darwin's book, a hypothetical rebuttal, that if the universe needs a designer, the designer must also need a designer. He responds that you don't need to provide an explanation for an explanation. That is, the explanation of the created universe is God, and that he does not need to explain the explanation, i.e. God. In fact, he doubles down by saying that it's an elementary point of science. First, it's important to note, and to make clear to the audience, not all sciences are the same. Cosmology is heavy in math and observation. It's the math part that Craig is abusing, because in math, any answer must in itself be explained, or to use the language of math, proofed. Craig then provides sort of an example from archaeology. There he states that we don't need an explanation about how machines were deposited on the moon to say that there are machines on the moon. But that's another sort of bait and switch. First, he has hard physical proof, i.e. they're in my hands, for the machines on the moon. Craig has only provided a possible explanation for cosmological constants. There's no proof. Secondly, the very next question out of an astronaut's mouth would be, where did this come from? Not, as Craig implies, it's there, so I guess that's it. Let's go home. But again, we have to remember why they use this argument, which is obviously flawed and wrong. But people like to feel special. One of the strongest biases the theist can call upon is that we all want to have meaning. We all want to feel special. This has been, according to some evolutionary psychologists, the roots of religion. That as we begin to understand the world around us, begin to make connections between the sky and agriculture, we saw that we could better understand the world as cause and effect. Why did the moon change? It was caused by two great deities playing hide and seek with the moon. It wasn't true, but provided a language for talking about the moon. The point being, you cannot just say the world is the way it is because of chance, or even laws of science. You must find a way to replace the awe of the God with the awe of the universe. Now, I'm sure you'll come up with better examples, but one I like to use, and there are many that will rely on the grandeur, but for me, a record is miraculous. If you think about it, a record, it's a plastic disc with a spiral groove. That groove has indentations on it. A little crystal rides along those grooves like a car would on a bumpy road. But unlike me getting carsick, the speakers magically create the Beatles concert or a classic symphony. Wow. Now, I have ignored the intelligent design argument, which I will address here. This argument is, okay, I'm throwing you a curveball. This time it's not Craig, who seems to sidestep this argument in general, but who wholeheartedly supports it. I could not find a succinct explanation from him. But here's fellow theist Stephen Meyer explaining intelligent design.
Intelligent design is the idea that there are certain features of living systems that are best explained by an intelligent cause rather than an undirected process, like Darwin's idea of natural selection acting on random variation. Intelligent design is not necessarily opposed to the idea of evolution. My theory of intelligent design, the one I've developed, challenging another theory of evolution, which also invokes only undirected mechanisms, and that's the theory of chemical evolution. And what chemical evolution attempts to do is explain the origin of the first life and any appearances of design that might be resident in the simplest single-celled organism. And I argue that, yes, there are very impressive appearances of design inside the cell. The most impressive of all is the information-rich DNA molecule and the information processing system that's used in the cell to express that information. And I argue that there are no undirected evolutionary processes that are sufficient to produce that based on what we know from having studied them. And yet there is a cause of which we know, and that cause is intelligence or mind.
So this is what I would call a rearguard action of the theist. There is no longer any doubt that evolution is true. Sorry, Southern United States. So, accepting that evolution may be true, yes, there are members of the conservative government and defiant U.S. Republicans who still doubt this, but they need to explain, how can you have evolution and God? Didn't he make a perfect world? Well, first, fundamentalists must always resist, but they may also sidestep. If the Bible is literally true, God made every animal. And if evolution is true, animals change over time. The only out is to assume that the changes over time, at least the big leaps, were divine. God did it because of some great plan or some great design. So you can have a random, natural, non-God-approved change in something like a flu virus, But you can't have big changes, monkeys into humans, without divine intervention. But why one and not the other? Some changes either are multiple. That is, many mutations are required to make the change work, as in the eye. The second objection is that some events are so improbable they must have been directed by some entity, by a maker. Think origin of animated life from inanimate material. For the skeptic, the first argument is simple. They're wrong. Every time they come up with an example of what they call irreducible complexity, i.e. something too complex to be natural, science, over time, has discovered that there are intermediaries. It removes the god of the gaps. To take one classic example, the eye. The theist would say the eye is too complex to have just happened. The science, and more to the point, in conjunction with paleontology, it has shown that light-sensitive cells evolved in bacteria, so they can partake in the most lighted area and generate more energy. Then these light-sensitive cells were used to detect whether there was something above them. In this context, it might mean an animal, a possible predator. Run away! These cells become concentrated in strategic locations, eventually formed an organ, a simple, then complex lens evolved, and with other simple but incremental changes, the eye as we know it, in its various forms, evolved. No god required. In fact, the eye has evolved many times. Compound, reflector, reflective, pit, spherical lens eyes, apositional, superpositional, you get the idea. Now at the base, the photoreceptor seems to be common to all. However, even our own, quote, camera-style eye has been independently evolved more than once. For example, we humans have a blind spot because our optic nerve is on the inside of the eye. At some point, it must pass through the retina to connect with the brain. This leaves a small hole in our vision. For wow factor, there's always ways to sort of demonstrate this fault in design. You then may point out that the same style of eye was evolved in octopus, but their optic nerve is, sensibly, on the outside of the eye, thus no blind spot. The logical points here are that first, we are not designed well. Blind spots, appendix, testicles, yada yada yada. So if designed, they're not really very intelligent. Secondly, creation implies unique design, i.e. every creature is created irrespective of other creatures. Intelligent design, not as strongly, but similarly implies that every creature was specially designed and should be as well as possible with little regards to previous iterations. Remember, they have to create a distinction between random, adaptive, directed evolution and divine evolution. Evolution predicts that we are variations of a theme. Therefore, we carry common traits from common ancestors. All eyes on Earth have opsins as a basic light-sensitive protein. As light and complexity increases, diversity increases, as well as evolutionary genealogies erode. Now, theists may retort that God allowed similarities in his creation as a form of economization of design, which does not explain why there are 10 basic designs of eyes. If you were economizing, there'd be one kind of eye. You may also ask the question, let's assume for the sake of your argument, that irreducible complexity did not exist. God did not want to be so obvious. In their own words, what distinguished the current scientific understanding of evolution from their theistic evolution? Often, at this point, the theist will fall back on the argument of probability. They will say the likelihood of an eye evolving naturally is one in a bazillion, next to impossible, therefore God. You may point out that maybe it was not God, but that Earth is simply an experiment by an alien race. However, the point of statistics is that the odds of you being struck by lightning is 1 in 7 billion. The odds of someone being struck by lightning is 1, as in someone somewhere in the world was just struck by lightning. As far as complexity, you could point out that the odds of you being born is, well, there are two people who are your parents, out of 7 billion. Of course, there's also the odds of my parents being born. That's likely 2 in 6 billion. Their grandparents, 4 in 4 billion. And you get a number like more atoms than there are in the universe once we have their great-great-great-grandparents figured in. Then again, it does not mean that this causal chain was necessary. That if at some point a pairing did not occur, that your humble theist would suddenly find themselves alone on the stage. You could say, if it was not particularly me, it would be someone like me. The odds that any one event is remote, but the odds of an event, not so much so. The odds of rain tomorrow is small. The odds of weather, not so much. But again, that was a rational argument. This is not meant to be a rational argument. We like to feel special. Intelligent design, the teleological argument, makes you feel special. That you are not just some random, unimportant thing in an uncaring universe. This argument also weighs heavily on our lack of understanding of the universe. Why do roosters crow at sunrise? Is it some obscure natural reason, or is it God's alarm clock? They know about alarm clocks, but I'm sure they're not quite up in their ontology. And even if we assumed that life on Earth, or humans in particular, were designed somehow, why God? It would be much more probable that aliens use the Earth as some kind of laboratory. Why more probable? Well, we know biological life exists. We know there are billions of planets in our galaxy. So probabilistically, it's likely aliens exist. It's very unlikely they have created laboratory Earth, but compared to the probabilities of a, let's use the first definition of God, spaceless, timeless, immaterial, again, an impossibility, zero probability, aliens for the win. This is one of the arguments where the skeptic can make a major point in the debate. Wow the audience. You must first accept the improbability of our own existence. It's a feckin' miracle, but not a divine one. In fact, the wonder is not in the acceptance of a non-answer, like God did it, we are his worshippers, but that of all the infinite possibilities, we are here today. Think about it. You are here today. Not created, not controlled, not commanded. But you exist as an independent, free-thinking person to live your life as you see fit. The theist may be comforted by being subjugated to some intangible deity, but myself, I revel in the opportunity that I have been given by life itself. Okay, this is where a good debater can win over an audience, even a theist audience, if done well. The theist really only has one card up their sleeve. The universe is magnificent. Feel special. Which is, to be clear, a reoccurring theme. But the atheist can get that card. Sure, it's a miracle we are here, but we also get to add the explanation as to why we're so special. The theist, when asked the question, how did we get here? Why is the universe the way it is? What's my purpose? They only have one answer, God. That's not an answer. It's a placeholder. God explains nothing more than saying to a child, where do babies come from? And you say, the stork brings them. Well then, where does the stork get them? It doesn't answer anything. It enlightens no one. And if you think about it, it doesn't really provide any comfort. This provides an opportunity to put the theist on the defensive, but you must be careful, it can backfire. Often, when push comes to shove, the theist will make a claim that they know God exists, that they have a personal relationship with God, they feel God, that he talks to them. If they make this argument, you can point out that the infamous serial killer, Son of Sam, was told to kill by the neighbor's dog. Make a point of saying, you're not saying God is a talking dog, irrespective that God spelled backwards is, I'll just leave that alone. Ask them if God told them to kill that person and point to someone in the audience. If that same voice reassures you that God exists, if that voice said kill that person, would you? They will of course try and deflect the question by saying something like God would never make such a request. But you press the issue by saying something like, I understand, but if God said that, if you were Abraham and told to sacrifice your son, would you? They will be put in a situation of saying either A, I would kill them, to which you press, how is that any different than the Son of Sam? I know you're not delusional. I believe that you don't believe you're delusional. But you have to see the point. I am sure David Berkowitz did not believe he was delusional, but if we think that there is an invisible person talking to us, saying what is right and wrong, well, I have to ask. If your personal God told you something evil, how would you know not to do it? Again, assuming you are not evil or delusional. Now, you could push the point home thusly by saying something like, now, I'm not immune to delusions, but I do have one extra defense. At no point would I think that God was telling me to do something. For me, it might be aliens, but never God. The biggest danger in belief of God is not the good people do, but the evil. Note that non-theists do evil as well, but they have one less excuse, one fewer avenues of delusion. If I walked around saying aliens were talking to me, that I was guided by aliens, that I hoped to forward the aliens' plans, well, at least people would keep an eye on me, if not have me locked up. However, if I said that I was guided by God, that I hoped to forward God's plan, I speak to God daily, well, I would be regarded as someone in the community as an upstanding, respectable person. I may even be elected to high office. That's fucking scary if you think about it. There are people right now torturing people via exorcism to expel demons. There are people right now praying to God to save their child instead of taking them to the doctor. Children have died in the belief of God. This is not to say non-believers do not cause suffering or death. It's just their delusions are not sanctioned as religious belief. They have to try harder to hide their mental illness. They are not told other people, quote, hear the voice of God too. Now take note, this last bit is very aggressive. Only use it if you think the audience is with you, if it's the right time. We'll return after this break with ways to go on the offensive.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
We're back. Okay, so far we've debated the proofs for God. What about a counterattack? First, you cannot attack. When put on the defense, people always retreat to a safe place. You need to be more passive-aggressive in a friendly manner. Something hard to do, and sadly, most prominent atheists lack. Yes, Richard Dawkins, I'm looking at you. Okay, not to be a complete hypocrite, I guess I should be looking at myself as well. One unusual argument is the problem of imperfection. This argument goes something like this. If God is perfect, and every aspect of him is perfection, remember, Craig established this in the ontological or multi-universe argument, so if God is perfect, and everything about him is perfect, then it follows everything he creates must also be perfect. If we created an imperfect world, let's say, our imperfect human bodies, well, that would be a fault and prove that God is not perfect. Lacking perfection, the ontological argument fails. It also creates a contradiction in the traditional definition of God, all-knowing, all-powerful, all-loving. Now, a rebuttal may come in the form of that, well, you could have a perfect God as well as other non-perfect stuff. But if there were other non-perfect stuff, who created that? The theist is committed to a universe completely created by God. However, the problem here is that people are people. We know the word perfect. We try and imagine what it would be. But of course, we are not perfect, so our imaginations are also imperfect. The theist will only have to hint that, well, I can make some stuff well, and I can make some other stuff not as well. So God can make parts of the universe perfect, be perfect, but on purpose, for some divine plan, put defects into his creation. You really cannot point out that perfection, as used in the argument, does not mean really, really good like it might in the real world. The best you can do is point out there are so many flaws that, well, if you were on the job, you would have been fired. A good one to bring up is birth. Giving birth is a very dangerous practice for many people, from misimplanted eggs to a pelvis smaller than a baby's head, and let's not forget hemorrhaging and septicemia. Another is the fact that we humans use the same tube to both breathe and consume, but only one at a time. Many creatures have separated these functions into two separate paths, think birds, which is much more safer. It removes the chances of choking and asphyxiation that often happens to people. You might also want to take the opportunity to review the theist argument, that the cosmological argument required a God outside of existence, and yet the ontological argument said God exists inside existence, and that you needed an infinite number of universes. But the teleological argument rules out an infinite number of universes, and the bad design implies an imperfect creation, if you assume a creation, and that there's no distinction between faith, a personal relationship with God, and a delusion. You can summarize from the argument that the theist has at best confused the question and at worst must accept complete failure. And here we will find the hardest nut to crack. People want to believe. If the universe is messed, but there is some divine power out there that can make it better or at least glean some meaning from suffering, well, that has value to people. Because the next most common argument against God is the problem of evil. But like perfection, how people really think undermines the philosophical power of this argument. The problem of evil goes, if God is perfect, in this case, all-powerful, as in can change anything, all-knowing, he's aware of everything that's going on now, then, and in the future, and all-loving, well, technically it's referred to as omnibenevolence, that is, God is perfectly good as well as always does good and kindness, the only way for evil to exist is for one of these to be false, and thus God is not perfect. Either God does not know evil is happening, or he is unable to prevent it, or he allows it, or just doesn't care. The classic rebuttal is to state that we are insignificant humans cannot possibly understand the complexities of the divine plan. Often, this compares the view of a child being slapped when they might burn themselves on a stone. From the child's perspective, the parent is evil, but we adults know that we're really helping the child. This breaks down on several levels. First, the perfection thing again. Seems a perfect God could make the world far more child safe. Okay, we can all die, but must we have so many horrific diseases that cause so much suffering? Create the one to keep us on our toes, but reality makes God seem of a bit of a bastard. And if you think about it, if we go by most doctrines, failure to comply with, quote, God's will results in an eternity of torture. Do we really need to suffer here on earth as well? And bringing up that all-loving thing again. Seems God is all-loving when we live, but once we're dead, he is such a fecker, if you think about it. He says, you will burn and suffer in hell forever for not being able to figure out which version of me you're supposed to worship. Okay, now, some theists will deny the existence of hell. To them, you can retort, you pick and choose which parts of the Bible are true and which ones are inconvenient. Is it divinely true or just basic guidelines to be adjusted as needed? What about accidental or undeserved suffering? Okay, if I tripped a nun, I can understand why God might punish me. But what about a newborn who experiences a horrific birth and quickly dies? Some religions say, if you are not baptized, then you must go to hell, regardless. Why must they suffer if God is love? There is also a degree of incongruity. There are some instances of suffering that cannot possibly have any part in some grand design. How many people died torturous but unknown deaths in war? What possible purpose could one find in a drug-addled mother deep frying their baby before dying of an overdose? The theist, you may point out, can explain away some evil as being part of some plan, but it is inconceivable that all evil is master plan, more specifically a perfect plan. In fact, I did hear an interesting take on this that reverses the problem of evil into the problem of good. How do we know God is good? Yes, it says so in the Bible, but wouldn't an evil God lie? If you added up all the good and evil, joy and suffering, I suspect you would get a net zero at best. The atheist could explain this away by the fact that the universe is probabilistic. The odds of you having a peaceful death versus a painful death is 50-50. Well, actually, let's think about that again in the problem of good. If you calculate the number of ways that you can die peacefully against the number of not-so-peaceful ways that you die, well, it seems like the number of non-peaceful deaths are orders of magnitude greater than peaceful death. So maybe we do have a God, but he's an evil God. But people don't want to hear that thought. It is the reality of the world that has allowed religion to flourish. So don't press this part of the argument home too much, but it does provide an opening. If you'd lived 2,000 years ago, you could expect to die by 30. 1 in 4,000 women died in childbirth. Starvation, violence, and oppression beyond what we can possibly conceive of today was the norm. Today, only the poorest of the poor can expect to die before 60. It's a rarity for a woman to die in childbirth. Starvation, a term even 50 years ago used, is almost unheard of now. It is so rare that it has resurrected as one of the dangers of global warming. Currently, we say the poor are food insecure. Violence. Day-to-day violence is so rare we no longer feel compelled to carry a weapon. Even in the gun-happy, fear-mongering USA, the vast majority of people walk the streets with little concern of getting into a fatal argument. And gone are the days when the king or the lord could put you to death for just looking at them the wrong way. Don't get me wrong, we are far from utopia. But much of this improvement in life is not found in the belief in a deity, but in science and knowledge. The theist can have his, quote, miracle of parting the Red Sea that may have helped a few hundred chosen people, but I prefer the miracle of the Green Revolution that saved billions. Now let me try out some counterfactuals. That is, let's assume something like God is still God, but not perfect. The gods of Greek, Roman, and Norse religion, forgive my Eurocentrism, but really all pantheist beliefs, none of these gods were perfect and still thought to exist. These gods are far more likely to have existed than the current flavor of Abrahamic religions. They were flawed, but in being so, much more probable, if still failing the sort of Occam's razors test. In fact, the idea that, quote, gods were really aliens is much more plausible than any god of the Bible. It is true that any technology sufficiently advanced can appear as magic or divine powers. There is the experiment, inadvertently, in the cargo cults that were created in the Pacific during World War II. As part of the American advancement on Japan, they used many islands as staging grounds. They placed on these lands provisions for the next sort of wave of attacks. Natives on these islands, isolated for hundreds of years, have seen nothing like the technology the army had. They had flying machines. They had flashlights, which for them were light rods. They had guns, which could kill people at a distance. It was complete magic to them. They created a religion out of the plains, chocolates, and gods from the sky. Again, if you must be a theist, it's far more likely God is an alien. Another counterfactual. Let's grant the theist is right, and God exists, and that he demands worship. It often goes uncommented on that the fact that a perfect being, well, his ego's pretty big. And then there's Hitler. Oh, crap, I just Godwined. Well, the point needs to be made. Just because an entity, God, alien, or Hitler, has power over me, that does not necessarily mean it needs to be respected or have my worship. Okay, let's assume God created the universe. He created me. He is all-powerful. Should I accept him into my heart? Should I bow down and worship him? Here the problem of evil becomes paramount. I cannot worship an entity that had the power to stop suffering in the world and chose not to. Full stop. Okay, maybe I'm too stupid to understand his purpose, but my ignorance is not my fault, but his. Again, thank you. I might be tortured for eternity because God made my understanding of the universe beyond my understanding, a limitation he created. Okay, and that leads to another problem. Does an all-loving God, God that loves me, well, does he lie to me? My parents lied to me on occasionally for my own good, so it's not a stretch that a God might lie to humans for our own good. So the problem here is, why has God limited our ability to understand why some evil is necessary? In a way, he must lie to us that evil is really good. It's just we don't understand why. But the limitations of our understanding is an aspect of our creation, and God created us, so it's an aspect of God. So he must think that at some point, lying is necessary. Otherwise, he would have let us know the answer to the problem of evil. Of course, the drop the mark argument is the multiple gods problem. If there is one God, why are there so many religions? If it were pop bands, no problem. Who cares if you like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones? However, if you believe in Zeus, that could condemn me to an eternity of torture. So if I were a deity, you would think, assuming I wasn't sort of a feck you or evil god, and assuming my ego did require constant affirmation, that I would either make it obvious who was the true God, or I would make disbelief, well, sort of time served. But what we are told by those who claim to have the truth, capital letters, that if we cannot decipher God's message, we are to be condemned to an eternity of torture. Some people argue, such as the new Pope, that hell is metaphorical, that it's not eternal torture or suffering, but something like isolation or loneliness while we're living. But one of the main tenets of religions, all beliefs in God, is the idea of sin. Not only must we accept God, and is not accepting God a sin in itself, but moving beyond that, but you must also follow a set of rules. If there is no punishment for committing sin, in the eyes of the theist, people would be constantly sinning. So it seems that saying hell is metaphorical is incredulous, claim made by the theist. So hell is hellish after all. Well, let's be Godwin again. If given the choice to worship an evil entity, yes, forcing one to comply to a mode of existence to me is totalitarianism, well, I will be willing to suffer for my convictions. So we've reached sort of the end of the debate. You must now assess, did I win the audience or not? Remember, the measure here is not a logical one, but an emotional one. Rhetoric over truth. I've kind of rambled on. I'm trying to provide a bit of a forum for discussion here about how to debate, what to debate with regards to God and rational and belief. I hope this helps some people. Anyhow, this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos.